Good morning. Good to see y'all. Everyone's up early. Times, they are a-changing. We don't know if that song was prescient or sadly missed the mark. But times are always changing. Ice came out of the lake, 3 days ago? About a month early. And here we are. So this talk that I've composed for today is called Cultivating Beneficial Mind. So this is derived from a list of beneficial aspects of mind from a text called The 30 Verses on Consciousness Only by a guy named Vasubandhu. And this list is faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion, energy, tranquility, carefulness, equanimity, and nonviolence. So I'm going to be talking about these qualities: faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion, energy, tranquility, carefulness, equanimity, and nonviolence. So this list is a little long. Probably any of these elements in here you could give a talk or maybe a week-long retreat just talking about one of them. But here today I'll just talk about them in the aggregate. So this list is composed from what's called the Yogacara body of teachings. And it's central to Buddhist thought that our action flows from our intention. So Buddha once said, karma is intention. As one wills, one does actions of body, speech, and mind. So the way our mind works is really considered primary to the possibility of us doing something to alleviate suffering in Buddhist thought. Or the Dhammapada, the first line is, our life is shaped by our mind. And the first two verses are, our life is shaped by our mind, we become what we think. Suffering follows a harmful thought like the wheels of a cart follow the oxen that draws it. Our life is shaped by our mind, we become what we think. Joy follows a pure thought like a shadow that never leaves. So, contrary to the way maybe we're conditioned or taught to live, spending a lot of time focusing on how our mind is functioning is thought to be very beneficial in Buddhism. That's why when we were all in first grade, we didn't learn to meditate. We learned to categorize and manipulate things we thought were external to ourselves. But this emphasis on mind, I think, is very helpful. So an intention here, or quality of mind, is closely related to emotion. So there's kind of like a bunch of words that have kind of mushy meanings. But we're talking here about aspects of how we are right now that are maybe have an emotional flavor or an affective flavor and impel us to do things. So like love or anger or desire. These impel us to do different kinds of things. And the thing is, a lot of times these things are impelling us to do things and we're unconscious of that impelling force. So I guess I always come back to this, but normally when we're angry, we don't think I am experiencing anger or this is anger. We think that person is a dick. So this is about coming in and saying, I am experiencing anger, or here's anger, or here's joy. So really having some awareness of what is driving our behavior. Because if we have some awareness of it, we can cultivate beneficial mind. So the way of cultivation, I'm actually going to de-emphasize during this talk the methods for cultivation and just talk about the qualities of mind themselves. And one of the reasons is that contrary to a lot of Zen teaching, actually talking about things and conceptualizing them is helpful. So, you know, all over the world, or at least all over the Midwest, because it's 10 o'clock on a Sunday, there are people sitting in groups like this, and one person is sitting in the front who's been empowered to talk. And they're talking about various things, but in a lot of those places, people are talking about, for example, loving your neighbor, or what you do for the least of these, you do for me. So people get together, and they take time to think about how to have beneficial intentions, or just think, oh, that would be really good to do that. And then we might remember it. You might go out into the world, and when you're about to do something kind of selfish or unpleasant, you might go, oh, that's right, beneficial mind. Oh, I want to do that. Or you might go, yeah, what you do for the least of these, you do for me. Which, for those of you who, like me, weren't raised Christians, a quotation from Jesus Christ. So, just taking time to conceptualize, think about, and encourage ourselves to do things is helpful. And so this talk, we'll cultivate beneficial mind just by me talking about it and you hearing it. Or actually, the real reason it will be powerful is, my guess is, you will devote your mind in a beneficial way to hearing it. So actually, what's most powerful about it is the commitment that you put into the practice of listening. And I hopefully put into the practice of speaking. I'll do my best. Or I hope so. I make that commitment. But we also have a lot of, as we go through this list, faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion, energy, tranquility, carefulness, equanimity, and nonviolence. As we go through this list, you may notice that it reminds you of the things that we do here at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center on a regular basis. So when we practice Zazen, we practice equanimity. We practice, and I will explain why this is true, we practice faith. We practice non-desire. So these qualities are inherent in the basic practices of this tradition. Mindfulness. Mindfulness is actually, it tends to contain a lot of these beneficial aspects of mind. Just being aware of what's here in a non-judgmental way, like here now. And simple tasks, you know, just like when you get up, making your cushion nice and round, standing it in the middle of the cushion and cleaning the cushion off. We emphasize these simple tasks here. And we allow a lot of opportunities for people to do simple tasks. After morning Zazen, we have work practice. And we set up the Zendo, or we reset the Zendo, or we clean the Zendo, or we shovel the lock. And we just do these simple things with all whole heart. And these are opportunities, because we're doing something simple, to be aware of the quality of our mind. And the one other thing I'd like to say about this way of cultivation is, the problem when I talk about a whole bunch of really wonderful qualities of mind is then we all go home and go, oh my gosh, I have horrible qualities of mind. I must be a bad person. I guess I can't do Buddhism. Buddhism is all those people doing all those great qualities of mind, and I'm just sitting over here being depressed or anxious or angry or hateful or exhausted. So it's very important that principally in cultivating beneficial qualities of mind, what we are doing is not combating something. That would be violence. And the last of these qualities of mind is nonviolence. So what we can do is, when we see, because we have some mindfulness, when we are aware that there's a harmful quality of mind, there's hatred or there's despair, that we can respond by meeting it with beneficial qualities of mind. So not forcing it away, but meeting it with an awareness that's nonviolent, that has some equanimity, so that that painful emotion can be seen. (Clears throat) So I'm going to jump on in here. The list, I'm going to repeat the list a lot because this is actually old school. This is how this tradition arose. People just say these lists over and over again. And so around here, we're not so into it. We have a literate culture, so you don't have to repeat things to remember them. We can just Google them. It's getting worse or better. I don't know which. But I'm not a Luddite, but I value aspects of human culture that have been carried for a long time that may get lost. Like calling this lake De Makska, which is an ancient name for it. Or I just heard the city is planning to have some kind of new historical marker or something to celebrate one of the first Native Americans to form a settlement along the De Makska. So this tradition of just repeating these teachings, actually just saying them over and over again, or hearing them over and over again, has value. It will begin to be a part of your makeup. So anyway, faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire and aversion, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion, energy, tranquility, carefulness, equanimity, and nonviolence. So faith, let's see, how many people are already thinking about leaving because I'm going to talk about faith? Well, these people come to Zen and they go, oh, I can go there and I don't have to believe in anything. Finally. Or maybe you're going, finally we're going to talk about faith. I love faith. Sounds good. Some words are very activating. I can think of some names that are very activating these days. So, faith. So I generally think of faith, and you know, I can unpack this at great length through different teachings of the Dharma, but I tend to describe this faith in Buddhist terms as being twofold. One is very explicitly non-ideological. That is, it is not faith in a set of ideas. So you want to remember that these beneficial qualities of mind are not ideas, but affective. They're emotional or intentional. They underlie thought. They're hard to define. So this faith is about trusting what is. Trusting what is. So this is the kind of faith that says, I don't have to run away from this moment and wait for another moment. I don't have to run from this me and wait for another me. And I don't have to run from you and wait for another you. But I have faith that this situation is complete. So these are words, so it sounds ideological, but at the bottom you see people who begin to manifest this kind of faith. And you just see their ability to stay home in the moment. So this is really what I would say in terms of Zen teachings is the basis of faith. And we can cultivate this. You cultivate this by sitting meditation. You learn that it's okay. You come here to do a retreat and you think you're going to get all peaceful and then you get all irritated. And you go, ah! And you go to the teacher and they go, good. You know, this is really weird. It's very weird. But what you see is that you can just be here. You can just stay home when you're irritated. And it can just come and go. And then that peace shows up. And wow, never had this kind of peace, this kind of tranquility. And then it goes away and you go, oh, I want that again. And then you go to your teacher and you go, oh, I want it again. They go, yeah, whatever. It's all right. We learn to trust that these things can come and go. And we have the strength to just be with them. We have the strength. We have the courage. So the other side of faith, which I would argue has a more early Buddhist flavor, is that you can do something to alleviate suffering. This is the central faith of Buddhist teaching. The Four Noble Truths principally says you can do something to alleviate suffering. And this is not a question of someday when you finally have beneficial qualities of mind. This is always now. You, every single moment that human consciousness exists, there is a capacity within it to do something for the alleviation of suffering. Fundamental empowerment. And we forget this. You know, you turn on the news and you go, it's too bad. All I can do is yell in my house by myself. Or maybe sit next to my spouse and we'll yell together. It'll be really fun. But you can always do something. The thing is, the framing of this teaching is that samsara, human suffering, is unbelievably vast. So it's not like Buddha said, yeah, you have the capacity to do something to alleviate suffering at some other time. No. Nor did he say you have the capacity to alleviate suffering when suffering is, you know, not so bad. Always. Always. So these are the two principal elements of faith. One, that you can just stay home and that this is okay. And yet, you can always do something beneficial. And I think if you look at your experience, you may see that sometimes you don't feel like you have this faith. Or we forget that what we are doing now could really be alleviating suffering for the world. And we kind of just go through same old thing, flipping through channels on the radio while we drive a car. Does anyone do that anymore? Is it all podcasts? I don't know. Whatever. You get the idea. So, faith. Faith, conscience. Conscience being the second on this 11th element in this list. By the way, there are 11 elements in the 11 beneficial factors, and it's the 11th verse in the 30 verses. I know you guys are excited. Really weird. Also, the 30 verses, every stanza is 30 syllables. There are actually none of you, except for those of you who studied 30 verses with me, are going, that's weird. There appears to be a complex system of numerology embedded in the 30 verses that no one has ever mentioned. I don't want to get into that. Yeah. That was how far I'm going to go. Just go, you know, human consciousness and creations are unbelievably complex. So anyway, faith, conscience. It's good to have a conscience. Now, later on in the 30 verses, Vasubandhu will point out that remorse can be either helpful or not. And so probably everyone in this room has spent some time unhealthily delving in remorse, just chewing on something they did wrong at great length. And it's, you know, painful, it doesn't help, we're stuck. We lose our sense that we can do something beneficial in this moment. So that happens. But conscience is important. It's important. You know, there's a great line in the Dhammapada that says, it is easy to see the faults of others. We winnow them like chaff. It is hard to see our own. We hide them as a gambler hides a losing draw. Mm-hmm. Another verse in the Dhammapada says, do not give your attention to what others fail to do. Give your attention to what you do or fail to do. So just taking time to focus on, like, you know, 12-step people do at the end of the night. Just do a little review of the day. How did I do? Not in a cruel way, but just, yeah. Oh, maybe I shouldn't have said that to that person. All right. Maybe tomorrow I'll say, I'm sorry. I can tell you this, that at my absolute best, I've been able to do this. Like, I had my son is older now, but he's a teenager, you know. Sometimes there were conflicts. It's hard to imagine, but true. And you know, I just remember there'd be conflicts, and at my absolute best, sometimes after one of those conflicts, after a little time had elapsed, there was some space, I could say, I'm sorry that I spoke harshly and sarcastically and impulsively out of anger. Period. and didn't have to say anything about. And, you know, if you wouldn't... So this is empowering. It's empowering to take, just take the opportunity to say, yeah, I recognize this and I can move on and not blame. Faith, conscience, humility. Humility is pretty good. I think about Tomoe Katagiri, who is one of the founders of this place with her husband, Dainin Katagiri. They came from Japan. And Tomoe Katagiri was basically transmitted the practice of Zen sewing to the United States from Japan, or was the first person to teach it. And now there are thousands of people who wear these... Oh, I let... Fortunately, mindfulness is not on this list. Anyway, so we wear these beautifully sewn things like this. Thousands of people, this has been central to all rites of passage in this tradition for 50 years and for a long time before that in Japan. And, you know, Tomoe is just, you would never know it if you met her. And there are people all over the country who are like, this is one of the most inspiring people I've ever met. You know, she transformed my life. And she's just like, come on in, how are you doing? You would never guess. So humility is not about, you know, oh, I can't do anything. She devoted herself to this thing. And if, you know, actually by the time she trained me, she kind of mellowed out, but she was known for being quite fierce in her teaching. Do it again. No. Where's your mind? Give your energy to this practice. So this humility wasn't about like, oh, I'm just going to sit in the corner and be a mouse. It's just stepping into the role. Now I'm a teacher. My job is to teach. Now I'm not teaching. So I don't have that whatever that is gone. And now we're here with this relationship. All right. Faith, conscience, humility. So then we have the set of three. Lack of desire, aversion, and delusion. So as some of you probably know, desire, aversion, and delusion are considered the three poisons. That's the normal term in Buddhism. They're central things that cause us to create suffering as human beings. And I'm actually going to approach these out of order. Whoa. Lack of delusion. Lack of delusion. Well, that sounds fun. Maybe. So as some of you know, in Mahayana terms, like in the Zen terms, basically delusion is anything that you think. So anything that is conceptualized and you're not aware that it's just a conception that isn't ultimately true is a delusion. So actually, if you have a conception and you're deeply aware that it's not ultimately true, that's not necessarily delusion. So I should be a little bit more precise in my language here. But generally speaking, there are a lot of things that we think are ultimately true, like I exist, or you exist as a thing separate from me, or someone separate from me, or that this space, or this culture, or all the people on this planet, and all the animals are separate from me. All that is delusion. So, no problem. That probably... For those of you new to this tradition, you're probably just like, great, you guys are weird. That may be true. But actually, this can be very freeing. This can be very freeing because we can become very trapped in our ideological situations. But I'm actually going to de-emphasize this, what I would call the more ultimate understanding of what delusion is this morning. And talk about the fact that delusion is also understood to be just thinking about things in a way that's harmful, and discernment is helpful. Let's see, in another list, the seven factors of enlightenment, the second element, discernment of phenomena. And we wouldn't have vast mountains of literature about Buddhism if someone didn't think that thinking about it was helpful. Now, it may all be telling you to stop thinking about
it.
Back to corollary A, we're kind of weird. But anyway, there is this fact that discernment is helpful. So it's a little bit dangerous, you know, we think delusion people, you can start to be like, well, you're deluded and I'm not. All those deluded people who are doing the bad things. And this is why it's pretty dangerous to not have this leavening element of delusion that realizes that all our conceptions are not ultimately true. But really, it's if we are unaware, I mean, delusion is about not realizing connection. It's about not realizing connection. So if you think that when your child is misbehaving, that, you know, all you got to do is yell at them and berate them and shame them into acting the way you want them to, it's based in a lack of awareness about your connection. You think of them as an object which can be controlled. And I think most of us are aware, and actually there's a lot of science that demonstrates that this way of trying to help children doesn't work very well in the long term. It actually is, it's known to be beneficial. You know, your kids will tie their shoes if you yell loud enough, but they'll have, you know, there'll be negative health effects for the rest of their lives, negative behavioral effects. So we get these delusions, and we might have a delusion that it's like, yeah, I'm just living my life over here, and it's pretty good. I'm pretty helpful, and there's horrible people doing things all over the world, and they're separate from me, and they're bad. But that is a delusion. We are connected inherently to all the systems of violence and power in the world. And this is always true. So we may want to think, you know, I think there was a strong delusion in Minnesota. We're like this beacon, and we don't have the racism is down there in the South. It's not true. You know, it's impossible for us to be separate. And that's wonderful, because it's wonderful to be connected to people. But it's also true that we're connected to them in all these systems of violence that come economically, through military power, through racism, sexism, oppression due to gender identity. We're part of it. So this requires some discernment. It's good discernment to do, to learn about, oh, there are people, there's really harmful things happening, and I'm part of that. And you can see why we don't want to do it. I think that's probably not hard to identify. So lack of desire and aversion. So now I'm working backwards through the list. Faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion. So now I'm coming back to desire and delusion. So this is kind of confusing, because you'd be like, well, how can you do anything if you don't have any desire? Isn't desire what makes you do things? Or like aversion? Like, I don't like that, so I'll try and get rid of it. But actually, and we will, by the way, all these beneficial qualities of mind are pretty good, but we are going to enact and experience their antitheses in enormous quantities for the rest of our lives. So this isn't like, yeah, just next week, get rid of all the desire, and then you'll finally have beneficial mind. No, that's not what we're doing here. But, so lack of desire and aversion, what we're talking about is just not wanting something else, or not trying to get rid of something. Now, it's a little bit hard to understand how, let's say, if you realize that, like, there's all this violence in the world, well, shouldn't I have a desire to get rid of it? But actually, these teachings says a more beneficial quality of mind is to approach this with desirelessness, which doesn't mean that the desire you have to end it is bad. It just means it would be beneficial to find some desirelessness. So I'm going to come down. So let's see. There may be sometimes, maybe not, when you are cooking dinner. Maybe you don't cook dinner where you're washing the dishes, but I'll use cooking dinner. You can, and if not you, you can imagine someone. You're doing something in the kitchen, like you're cutting something, and for just a moment, you're not waiting for it to be done being cut. And you're not anticipating what it will taste like. You're just actually doing what you're doing. That happens. The thing is, actually, it happens, but we usually don't even know it happens because the reason it's happening is we're absorbed in our activity. So, likewise, you might find yourself taking care of someone in your family who's terminally ill. So you find yourself at a nursing home. Someone is profoundly ill. And, you know, usually a lot of desire and aversion and painful emotions and wonderful emotions flow from this kind of experience. But there may be a moment or two, or maybe numerous moments, where you're just there with that person and you're just there. You don't have any expectation that they're going to get better because you've realized that's not happening. And you're not waiting, oh, maybe they'll be relieved and they'll die. You're just there. And maybe they're telling you a story and you actually are able to just listen. So this is, the lack of desire and aversion is an aspect of our lives that happens, but can be cultivated. And in both these cases, by the way, it's not like we're not doing anything. We're actually making dinner. Or we're actually being there for someone who profoundly needs someone to be there for them. So this is why, you know, many Zen teachers like to say, don't sit to become a better person or to be happier or to even alleviate all beings from suffering. Sit just to sit. What they're saying is, practice sitting as an activity of non-desire and non-aversion. And you can bring this, you can bring this into your life so that when you it's like you go to a town hall meeting, you go to a political meeting, and you can just offer your effort. It's possible to just offer your effort there and not be waiting for the result. And actually, it's nice because then when the result doesn't come, which happens frequently, I think, you're not like, God, you know, I'm hopeless, I'm enraged. Instead, this is like, what? I did my thing. What's next? What's next? Because what's next is energy. Energy, faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion. Energy. Now, energy, I thought Zen was going to be all about, like, dude, just chilling out, man. Mm-hmm. I'm on the beach. I have a Zen-like calm. How many times have you read about that? Someone on the beach having a Zen-like calm. There's going to be Zen beer pretty soon, so just get ready. There's already a Zen bar. I think when you first came to Zen, you were like, is it going to be the Zen bar or the Zen center? Worked out well for us. And that's discernment. So anyway, energy. Energy shows up on countless lists of different kinds of lists of beneficial factors. The four powers, the five faculties, five powers, six paramitas, seven factors of enlightenment, eightfold path, all of them, energy is a component. It takes energy to do this. It takes energy to do this. You got it. I mean, it's like I just get up. I wake up on Tuesday and Thursday morning. I wake up for morning zazen and I go, I don't wanna. And then I find some energy and I come here and I sit. And I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful. Tranquility. Faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion, energy, tranquility. I'll just say, for those of you who've experienced this, I think you'll just know exactly what I mean. And for those of you who don't, maybe you'll feel the flavor of it. If you come here for a retreat, especially a longer retreat, some point a few days into that retreat, you walk onto the porch during a break, and the feeling of peace, that you can have that room, that little porch filled with 15 people, and it's profound, profound tranquility. But it's energy. People are putting they're just there in their lives. And it comes from their commitment to coming in and sitting, and they go, oh, my back hurts. I'm tired. I don't wanna. And yet. Faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion, energy, tranquility, carefulness. Carefulness. Just taking care of what's in front of us. Simple tasks. Raking. Vacuuming. Dust mopping. Listening. Really caring when you listen. Speaking with carefulness. Speaking with carefulness is a long learning process for me. It's like 20 years ago, I got to learn how to not lie all the time. And then I got to learn how to not be super sarcastic. And, you know, and I just keep refining. Keep refining. Carefulness. Like taking care of what we choose to do moment to moment. Faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion, energy, tranquility, carefulness, equanimity. Equanimity. So, equanimity, sometimes people might say this is acceptance, or radical acceptance. Sounds pretty good. But actually, I will quibble. Why not? So, equanimity is not ideological. So this is not about accepting something. It's not about saying, this is okay. It's about not reacting emotionally. So the difference is between saying, I have cognized these things and I'm saying they're all right and I will accept them with equanimity, and saying, I'm going to cultivate non-emotional reactivity. So for example, if you see someone wearing, a woman wearing a hijab, and someone is saying something racist to her, equanimity is not an invitation to accept that situation. But this teaching does say it is beneficial to cultivate non-reactivity. That is to say, to not make it about me. Now I'm angry, and what I'm going to do is try and deal with my anger. What I can do is I can say, I can cultivate non-reactivity and try and make space for the whole situation to be there and then act in the most compassionate way possible. Because the reactivities are, they become overwhelming, they become painful, they become distracting. So this is not about accepting, but about cultivating not having intense emotional reactions. Faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion, energy, tranquility, carefulness, equanimity, and nonviolence. Oh, my favorite. Ahimsa. Ancient Indian term. Nonviolence. Just not trying to harm something. Only understanding what that means is an infinitely deep invitation to look at your relationship with reality. On the most fundamental level, Buddhism says that to conceptualize things is intentionally a violent act. It is an act of extracting an element from the universe so that the mind can manipulate it, so that we can finally somehow think we can figure things out and be all right. So that's the deepest level. But on another level, it's just realizing, you know, sometimes we actually just want to hurt somebody. You know, like,
jab you.
Well, the first step is to cultivate the capacity to not want to do that. And then we can keep broadening and cultivating this capacity to just say, whatever comes, I'm going to respond with nonviolence. And this is not easy to do. But there have been some incredible exemplars in the 20th and 21st century. So there's a lot to learn there. Faith, conscience, humility, lack of desire, aversion, and delusion, energy, tranquility, carefulness, equanimity, and nonviolence. And if you're like me, I don't know why that would be. Maybe we are alike. Maybe you go, but what about compassion? Vasubandhu? Where's that on your list? I studied the 30 verses for years, and I'm like, this is really weird. It never says compassion, which is this. Isn't that the fundamental underpinning of Mahayana thought, and this is a Mahayana text? What's going on? Well, actually, a huge half of the 30 verses is about realizing interdependence. And interdependence and compassion are identified. That is to say, they are identical. They are the same thing in most Mahayana texts. The thing is, compassion is not emotional or affective. It's space. It's boundarylessness. So compassion is being with other emotions. It's not its own emotion. It's space for other people's emotions to exist. So all of these beneficial factors cultivate our capacity to make this space. If we have equanimity, we can make space for someone else to be really angry and to be able to just be there and not have a desire to make them be something else. Or if someone is in despair, to just be there and not have an aversion to being close to that suffering, but actually to be there and enact faith that this moment is okay and we can do something helpful and some discernment, some non-delusion to figure out what that helpful thing might be, which might be to just keep listening. What might be to reach out a hand. Or might be to go vote. Or might be to make some soup. Or might be to walk down the street waving a sign. So, just back to this earlier point, we talk about all these wonderful qualities of mind. It's very easy to think they're like some kind of ultimate state which we should be attaining, arriving at. It's not so. They're just encouragements of things we can cultivate within ourselves. So it's not about being like, when I have desire, I'm bad, or it's bad. That's just violence. We can just meet that with some equanimity or some space or some nonviolence. So we'll have all kinds of things arise in our consciousness, but we can continue to cultivate these aspects, and beneficial engagement with the world will naturally flow out of us if we do this. Well, thank you. And we have a few minutes here for other voices.
Ben, could you just talk for a minute about how this fits into Vasubandhu's larger work?
Yes. How does this fit into Vasubandhu's larger work? Basically, Vasubandhu, to try and make a simple explanation, he says that the way our mind is functioning is basically all we have. Moment to moment, our mind constructs an experience. And so there's a couple things that would be really good to do. Cultivate beneficial mind states and practice shedding harmful ones. And then cultivate our sense of connection to everything within this moment of experience. So normally we kind of feel like it's a me here and everything out there. We're just trying to open up those boundaries, soften them. I mean, use boundaries when we need healthy boundaries. But soften our boundaries, open up our beneficial intentions, and have some faith that that's going to benefit everybody.
What language is each of the 30 verses and 30 syllables?
Sanskrit. Yeah. Chris.
If compassion is not an emotion, what is it that I'm feeling when I see someone in distress?
So I think I'll talk from my experience. So, well, sometimes when we see people in distress, we experience, you know, we don't feel any connection to those people. But I assume you're talking about in circumstances where you're like, this is compassion. So the thing is, the compassion is the permeability of the barrier of yourself to actually be close to them in that. And then usually in a moment like that, there's a combination of mental factors. So you have your own pain comes up. Like if I see a homeless person who is asking for money, and then it's complicated because I'll be like, oh, that looks, you know, they look kind of tired. And so I feel some compassion for them, but I also feel like, oh, what am I supposed to do? So I feel uncomfortable, mm-hmm. and then I feel some shame, you know, maybe I'm too privileged. So I get a whole bunch of emotions. So that part is reactivities. So there's a lot happening. So what this invitation is to do is to diminish these reactivities, diminish that boundary, and more just let that experience of knowing their suffering be spacious. Yes?
There's a wonderful example, if you want to practice. I've noticed the last few weekend mornings, at least there's a fellow that's standing on the corner out here at the West Lake of the Isles, or East Lake of the Isles, and you know, where the Excelsior, the Lake Street, the big intersection where the light takes forever. And he has his sign, and he's been dying of liver cancer for a long time now, according to the sign. But, so he really is one of these folks that stirs up a lot of the emotions that you talk about. And I noticed yesterday that, you know, he was really pretty jittery. He needs a drink. Otherwise, so, you know, it's amazing how just being with him for the 30 seconds or 60 seconds or 2 minutes, and some days I give him some money and some days I don't, you know, but he's always out there, so you always have an opportunity to experience all of this. And as you say, just be with him, compassion, being with those feelings.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know if you guys could hear that, but he's just talking about how, you know, seeing someone engaging in panhandling is an opportunity. It's an opportunity.
Do you know John Ruskin?
He's like a 19th century Oxford professor.
Yeah, he was a huge influence on Gandhi.
Ooh!
Yeah, and he loved drawing, and he felt everybody should take up a drawing practice.
Drawing?
Yeah, and not because for the artistry, but because it helps us pay attention. And it helps us just quiet down and calm down and just really see something and be with something. And he said for an artist to draw a tree to make a work of art, he thought it was an act of violence because you were turning it into something.
Mm. Yeah, cool.
He's a really cool guy.
Thank you.
At the risk of being thought violent, go deeper into this question because I think there's a danger in making violence everything.
Yeah.
Mm. And so in the case where you were talking about somebody abusing a woman with a hijab, maybe physically, there is somebody there who will suffer physical harm. Mm. And you cannot be even-handed in that situation, it seems to me. The response, you need to figure out how to intervene in a way that protects the person who is the target of that real violence.
I totally concur. Yeah, I may have been unclear about my meaning, but that is actually the idea, yeah. But I'm sorry to cut you off. Do you want to keep?
Oh, well, I was going to add, I guess, that there are rapid response teams that are forming in response to the deportation movement that the government is mounting, where people will go and offer nonviolent opposition to the efforts of the ICE squads when they come and try and deport people. There are active bystander training programs where you can go and help prepare yourself for those kinds of situations where something is actually happening on the street and you're a bystander, how can you productively intervene? So I would suggest following up and investigating those things.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and I'll just reiterate that my point was the more I can be not about my own reactivity, but be about discerning that this is harm and my action comes from that, which, the invitation was to intervene for sure. This is not about passivity at all. This is total engagement. I saw another hand, maybe. Yes. Lena, I'm going to just ask you, since you're in the back, to talk loud so they can hear you.
I'll try.
Thank you.
I actually feel like out of the three evil things, aversion is pretty strong in me.
Mm.
And I noticed I totally spaced out when you were talking about aversion.
Mm. That was the boring part anyway.
Yeah.
I want to say one thing and then ask a question. When you were talking about equanimity, you mentioned, and the example with the woman in hijab, you mentioned that intense emotional responses are not kosher, whatever. And I think I kind of disagree with that. I think intense emotional response, I don't think I equate that to lack of equanimity. It could translate to lack of equanimity, and it could translate to also energy and discernment, and it, you know, depends what you do with the intense emotional response. I wonder if you have some thoughts on that. And then the other thing was the suffering, you mentioned earlier on that we always have an opportunity to reduce our suffering. And the reduction of suffering, it could also be painful to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if you could say something about what, why that is.
Yeah, well, to say the first one first, the reduction of suffering is for everything forever. So that means in any given moment, it might be very painful to do that act that will be reducing suffering in the long term. So surgery, recovery from addiction, not easy, I guarantee it. I've heard. So you know, lots of things like that. Or civil rights movement of the 1960s in the United States was not easy. It was very painful, and yet was conducive to long-term benefit. So the thing is, having said that, and there's a great early Buddhist sutra where someone is trying to get Buddha to explain what you should do, and to make it simple, he says, if it's painful or not painful and it's conducive to long-term benefit, then you should do it. If it's painful or not painful, it is not conducive to long-term benefit, you shouldn't do it. Pretty simple. But anyway, to the question of intense emotion, so this is why it's tricky. This is not about kosher or not kosher. So when there's intense emotion, this is about meeting that emotion, as I said at the beginning, with the most beneficial capacity that you have. So, of course, we're going to have all kinds of intense emotions. So it's not like bad and good. It's just that it is worthwhile to cultivate beneficial emotions. So it's worthwhile to cultivate non-aversion, maybe. You can figure that out for yourself, but I'll make that argument. Cultivate non-aversion or non-delusion because we can just see how people who have done this have done amazing things. I mean, Gandhi didn't just help transform his country, but he did it through the means of not hating. Nelson Mandela transformed his country through the means of non-hatred, non-violence. This is a capacity that we have not only culturally, but personally, interpersonally. So it's not about doing violence to our emotional state or saying, no, I have these emotional states, I'm wrong or bad. It's about meeting those with nonviolence. It's about meeting other people's emotional states with nonviolence. It's about meeting systems with nonviolence. Always available. It's kind of a, it sounds like a high bar, but if then if we go, but it, we're accepting who we are. To not accept who we are is violence. So I hope that's a helpful answer. You know what? We have to wrap up, but I would love to chat after the talk, or if anyone else wants to. And so, thank you all very much. I'll turn this over to Jim.